Okay, I'm back for the second part of Chapter 15 on Exchange Rate Systems. When we left off, I believe we had just finished up a brief discussion about the Bretton Woods system, which was a rather rigid fixed exchange rate system among the major currencies of the world. It turned out to be too rigid. There wasn't enough flexibility, and faced with a persistent imbalance in the supply and demand for dollars, the system fell apart, and since then, the major currencies of the world, or at least the United States and many others, have been on a floating or a managed floating exchange rate system. Now, if you go back to our slides, slide 13, entitled Bretton Woods and After, it gives you a brief summary of the advantages and disadvantages of both the extreme types of exchange rate systems, that is, a fixed exchange rate versus a floating exchange rate system. With a fixed exchange rate system, which was the Bretton Woods system, you have the certainty provided by a known fixed exchange rate. A disadvantage, and this isn't altogether clear, but let me try to explain this. If you put the central bank in charge of controlling or setting the value of a currency, then that becomes the one objective of the central bank, and it can't also pursue an independent monetary policy. In other words, the Federal Reserve or a central bank can only do one of two things. It can pursue independent monetary policy and independent interest rates and internal value of its currency, or through monetary policy, or it can fix the external value of the currency, that is, the exchange rate. A central bank only has one tool. It controls bank reserves. It can't control two variables with that one tool. That is, it can't control interest rates and the internal value of a currency, as well as the exchange rate. So if a central bank is going to be in charge of setting the exchange rate, monetary policy, independent monetary policy. All right, continuing with fixed exchange rates, because one advantage is because you do not have an independent monetary policy, that is, the Federal Reserve or the central bank cannot increase the money supply rapidly in order to try to attempt to increase economic activity, a fixed exchange rate regime imposes discipline on the central bank. Again, it can't independently increase the money supply. Its job becomes simply one of buying and selling foreign currencies to keep the exchange rate fixed. So that's an advantage. An advantage is that a fixed exchange rate regime, again, imposes discipline on the central bank. A disadvantage is if it becomes clear to participants in the foreign exchange market that a particular fixed exchange rate is unsupportable, it cannot continue. Maybe, for example, Mexico is pegging the peso to the dollar at 10 pesos to a dollar, and there are market pressures for the peso to depreciate. And so the Mexican central bank is, in order to keep the peso from depreciating, is buying pesos, selling dollars. And speculators may recognize that Mexico has a limit on the number of dollars it can sell. And when it senses that the 10 peso to a dollar fixed exchange rate will not be possible persistently into the future, there's going to be a devaluation of the peso, then central bankers speculators will start trying to sell their pesos, adding further fuel to the flames for the peso to depreciate. And the Mexican central bank at some point will run out of dollars and will fail to be able to keep buying pesos, selling dollars, and indeed the peso-dollar relationship, that fixed exchange rate, will not be able to continue. That's an example of a speculative bubble. Well, looking at slide 13, floating exchange rates. And there's a lot of advantage. I think the economics profession probably in balance is in favor of floating exchange rates. The advantages surpass the disadvantages. Why, as I mentioned in the first lecture, an exchange rate is just a price in markets. There's a lot of support for the notion that markets need to set efficient prices. Furthermore, a floating exchange rate allows governments to central banks within that nation to pursue independent monetary policies, which may be of a lot of some value. We've seen in the United States in the last almost 20 years, there's the central bank under the leadership of Paul Volcker and then Alan Greenspan have probably conducted monetary policy in such a way that has led to increased stability of the U.S. economy. It's nice to have the tool of monetary policy to combat the economic cycles, recessions. Well, moving along. Where are we at? A little more about the characteristics of floating exchange rates. We're done with the Bretton Woods system. Now we've looked at a little chart that shows the advantages and disadvantages of flexible versus floating exchange rates. Now let's just focus on some of this is a repeat. Let's focus in slides 14 and 15 on the characteristics of a floating exchange rate system. Now again, with a floating exchange rate system, you just let market forces, private market forces, individuals and other entities simply will be buying and selling currencies to finance capital purchases across borders, to finance the trade of the flow of goods across borders. And the exchange rate will just adjust based on supply and demand conditions. If there's an increase in U.S. interest rates, which attracts a large capital inflow into the United States, foreigners have to first buy the dollar to purchase U.S. assets. Under a flexible exchange rate system, under a floating exchange rate system, ceteris paribus, the increase in U.S. interest rates will cause the value of the dollar to rise. So there'll be this will be reflected in this dollar appreciation will have impacts. Exports, example, will probably fall. Imports will rise. And there may be a deficit in the current account, which will offset the surplus in the capital account, because the capital inflow results in if we started at a zero balance in the capital account, a capital inflow will cause a surplus in the capital account, but the dollar appreciation will cause a deficit in the current account, which brings about an overall balance in the balance of payments. So under a floating exchange rate system, the exchange rate will adjust to equilibrate the overall supply and demand of foreign exchange. So we'll always have a overall balance in the balance of payments. If the central banks are not required to fix the exchange rate, they will no longer need to be able to buy and sell foreign currencies. They don't have to hold foreign exchange reserves. If the Mexican government wants to allow the peso and the dollar exchange rate to float, whatever market forces set that exchange rate at, the Mexican central bank does not need to buy and sell dollars. Hence, it does not need to hold dollars. It doesn't have to sell dollars. It doesn't need to have dollars to sell. So those are some advantages. And we mentioned that it gives one of the huge advantages of a floating exchange rate system is it allows for an independent monetary policy. One of the disadvantages, I suppose, going to slide 15, is that market rates may move erratically. And that's, of course, one of the advantages of a fixed exchange rate system is the certainty provided by a fixed exchange rate. Between the extremes of a floating exchange rate and a fixed exchange rate is the managed float. And although the United States, after the Bretton Woods, moved towards a floating exchange rate system, it hasn't been a pure float. A managed float is the description of a exchange rate system in which governments sometimes intervene in the exchange markets to manage or try to influence the market-determined exchange rate. So it's not a pure float. Governments just stay out. do not buy and sell foreign currencies. In a managed float, governments, in a coordinated fashion usually, will get together and decide exchange. The market determined exchange rate is for a particular currency is too high or too low, and then they'll those countries will, in a coordinated way, enter the exchange markets to try to change the exchange rates. This was the original purpose, or one of the original purposes, of the Group of Seven, the G7 nations. I'm sure you've all heard about the G7 nations. Much of the reason, a key reason they originally met and formed the Group of Seven was to discuss exchange rates. Originally, the dollar was perceived as too high in the mid-1980s. And if the dollar is viewed as too high, countries that belong to the G7 would, in a coordinated fashion, central banks within those nations would sell dollars in the foreign exchange markets to try to drive the dollar down. That's the notion of a managed float. We're going to let the market set exchange. What I was trying to say before I was interrupted is that in slide 17 we have the dollar-franc exchange rate. If I can get back to slide 17. Yeah, so on the horizontal axis we have the quantity of francs, on the vertical axis we have the price of the franc in terms of dollars. And so let's start out. We start out in the left-hand panel with supply and demand for francs such that the equilibrium price of francs is 50 cents at point A. Now what we assume in this example is there is some temporary increase in demand for francs as a result of higher Swiss interest rates, for example. And so let's assume there's a blip in U.S. excuse me, there's a blip, upward increase, temporary increase in Swiss interest rates. So U.S. residents are trying to buy francs with which to then buy Swiss assets. That would cause, in the absence of any intervention in the exchange markets, a movement from A to B. It could be a very quick move. It could be it happened in a very short period of time, hours, from 50 cents to 60 cents. And let's assume that this is not a permanent change in the underlying fundamentals that would cause the Swiss franc exchange rate to differ. And so eventually the exchange rate will end up back at A. So we, absent intervention, would go from A to B and then back to A. That's what we have. That's what's illustrated in the right-hand side of panel, the right-hand panel of slide 17. Now this is so you have some temporary movement, no long-term movement, just a blip, a bump in the road with respect to the exchange rate. This is viewed as undesirable, and since there was no long-term or long-run change in the exchange rate, it could be argued that the central banks could intervene and keep the exchange rate at A all the time, all along, rather than have the move from A to B, just keep it at A. Looking at the left-hand side, ask yourself, what would that require if the central banks knew the underlying equilibrium exchange rate was still 50 cents per franc, and they didn't want some temporary change in that exchange rate. But faced with an increase in demand for francs, what the central banks in the United States and Switzerland would have to do what? Well, looking at the left-hand side of panel of slide 17, at 50 cents per franc, given the new demand for francs represented by D subscript 1, there's an excess demand for francs. The central banks, therefore, would have to enter the foreign exchange market and sell francs, supply those extra francs, sell francs, buy dollars, to make up for that excess demand for francs derived from private market forces. And then when that excess demand for francs disappeared, the central banks would then quit selling or supplying the extra francs, and the exchange rate would stay at point A. That's the story. I think I'll end this lecture. A central bank can also engage in traditional monetary policy to stabilize an exchange rate. And this is illustrated in slide 18. So in this instance, rather than directly buying and selling the currencies, we're just going to engage in traditional monetary policy. And remember, traditional monetary policy, a central bank buys and sells bonds. The U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, that is, buys and sells U.S. Treasury bills, bonds, notes to increase or decrease the money supply. Let's see how that works. In the left-hand panel of slide 18, we start out with an initial exchange rate of $2 per pound at point A. And then let's say that there's a, in this instance, I think there is a something that causes an initial decrease in the demand for pounds. I don't know. Maybe it's a decrease in British interest rates. For whatever reason, there's a private decrease in demand for pounds, which, if nothing was done, the price, the dollar price of pounds would go from $2 to $1.80. That would be a pound depreciation or a dollar appreciation. Now, if the Federal Reserve, that is the U.S. Central Bank, wants to prevent the dollar from appreciating, again, going from 2 pounds to a dollar to 180, going from $2 per pound to $1.80 per pound, that's a dollar appreciation, a pound depreciation. If the Federal Reserve wanted to keep the dollar from appreciating, it could do the following. It could buy or sell pounds. I'll let you figure out which it would need to do, but it could also just increase the money supply by buying U.S. Treasury bills, bonds, and notes, which would decrease U.S. interest rates. So what we're illustrating in the left-hand panel of slide 18 is the U.S. Central Bank, that is the Federal Reserve, in order to keep the dollar from appreciating, the central bank increases the money supply, which there's some intuition here. Increase the money supply would decrease the, since money's connected to the domestic value of a currency, increase the money supply would decrease the domestic value as prices rise, which would also, ceteris paribus, you would think, decrease the exchange rate value of the dollar. But to fill in the details, in order to keep the dollar from depreciating, the U.S. Central Bank increases the money supply, could increase the money supply, lowering U.S. interest rates, which would result in a decrease in the foreign demand for U.S. assets. In other words, it would be fewer British residents going to the foreign exchange market to sell their pounds and buy dollars with which to buy U.S. assets because our interest rates are lower. This is represented by a decrease in supply of pounds, so the exchange rate would stay at point C. That's all we're saying here. So that's the nature of a managed float. Central banks can intervene by buying and selling currencies or engage in some kind of monetary policy to keep the exchange rates fixed. Now, concerning the history, there's no slide on this, but let me just mention this briefly. There's some discussion about it in the book. The history of U.S. intervention in the foreign exchange markets. At the end of the Bretton Woods system, 1973, that's when the Bretton Woods system ended. The U.S. Central Bank didn't intervene in the foreign exchange markets to a considerable extent for the first few years under the new managed float or the post-Bretton Woods system. So, I don't know, the second part of the mid-1970s, not a lot of market intervention by the U.S. Central Bank. In other words, we let market forces determine exchange rates. And the dollar depreciated over this period. And that brought on a couple years of, say, 1977 through 1979, substantial intervention by the central bank trying to affect the price of the dollar to keep it from depreciating. Then part of the Reagan perspective of free markets, this notion of markets are always right, spilt over into Reagan's and his administration's view of the exchange rate markets. And they were led, their political view and economic views were such that markets forces set the price of the dollar on the international exchange markets. And so there was very little market intervention between the period 1980 and 84, a period of time characterized by rapid and substantial dollar appreciation, which brought about the, I can't pronounce the word, the Louvre Accord of 1980-something, mid-80s, in which many countries viewed the dollar as overvalued, and so there was substantial intervention for a couple years, 1985, 86, 87, by the U.S. Central Bank and others to lower the value of the dollar. And then, since the late 1980s, there's been modest, very modest, frankly, intervention by the U.S. Central Bank in the currency markets. There's been intervention by other nations, but the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has, for the most part, allowed market forces to set the exchange rate. Now, let me stop there for a minute, because I'm not sure what else I want to cover. I'll end this lecture with a brief discussion of so-called currency crises, of which there have been a number. I suppose many of you have heard about the East Asian currency crisis, or the Russian currency crisis, or the Argentinian currency crisis. So what is a currency crisis? Going to slide 20, it gives us the characteristics of a currency crisis. Normally, it's a situation where there is some kind of fixed exchange rate that is fundamentally out of balance, and the nation that's trying to keep that exchange rate fixed, faced with speculative forces, is unable to, and the currency consequently drastically and rapidly depreciates. For example, maybe back to my Mexican dollar peso example. Let's say the exchange rate is fixed at 10 pesos per dollar. There are underlying forces to, depreciate the peso. To keep the peso from depreciating, the Mexican Central Bank is buying pesos, selling dollars, and the Mexican Central Bank is running out of dollars to sell, and speculators know that. They consequently try to unload pesos, which further depreciates the peso, and at some point the Mexican Central Bank cannot prevent the overwhelming market forces from causing the peso to depreciate. That is, and if the peso dramatically depreciates, then we have a currency crisis. And historically, these currency crises have been linked to underlying problems in an economy. In the peso, Mexican example, maybe the reason the peso is depreciating is there's high unemployment, there's instability, there may be political instability, there's very little foreign investment in what foreign assets are owned in that country. Investors are trying to sell those assets and take their capital home, which may be the problem. Think of what would happen in the United States if the U.S. has been attracting a lot of foreign investment from overseas for a number of years now. Now, if the Japanese and the Europeans and all the foreign investors decided they no longer wanted to buy our assets, they'd quit buying our dollars to buy those assets, and then say they wanted to sell the assets they have. They want to unload their treasury bills, their stocks, their real estate, the other assets they own in the United States. So as foreigners sell those assets and quit buying U.S. assets, there'd be a dramatic decrease in the demand for dollars. In fact, as they sold their assets and tried to supply those dollars to the foreign exchange market to convert them to their own currencies, there would be an increase, huge increase in the supply of dollars, a decrease in demand for dollars. There would be a dramatic dollar depreciation. That would be a currency crisis. Now, I'm not here to say that the U.S. is about to suffer a currency crisis, but you could see the forces that would cause a dramatic decrease in the value of the dollar. If foreigners lose faith in the U.S. economy, maybe we have some political instability. The Iraq war drags on and causes problems, additional problems. Maybe there's high unemployment. We have a dramatic increase in oil prices. Some perception that the U.S. economy has suffered a large blow, and it's not a good place to invest anymore. So it'd be capital flight away from the U.S. And if the dollar, there would be forces for the dollar to dramatically depreciate. That would be a currency crisis. A number of these have happened to many nations around the world. Well, I think I'll let you read about the so-called currency crises. And one thing the currency crises, currency crises have led to is so-called capital control. So in my example, one cause we can see of a currency crisis is capital flight. That is, if all foreign investors right now decided they didn't want to invest in the United States and sell what assets they own in the United States and take their capital and go home, that would dramatically depreciate the dollar. Well, to keep that capital flight from occurring, nations impose capital controls. They'll regulate who to what extent nations, foreign nations can, residents of foreign nations can purchase assets, and conditions under which they can sell those assets and convert the dollars, or whatever the domestic currency is, into some foreign currency. So Mexico may have capital controls regulating foreign purchase of Mexican assets and foreign sell of Mexican assets and converting Mexican pesos into other currencies. I think that's about it. There's a little discussion of currency boards and dollarization. I think I'll leave that to you. If you have questions, send them along. This lecture's went on very long at this point. I think we'll end there. Bye-bye.